court denied the EJIA petition of the plaintiff, and we're arguing that the court abused its discretion in doing so for two reasons. First, the case involves much more than simply a minimal articulation grounds for reversal. And second of all, the district court treated Stein as if it was a per se rule, and per se rules are generally not permissible under Underwood in EJIA cases. Now, in this particular case, in the merits decision of the case, the district court found that the commissioner had violated ruling 96, Social Security ruling 96-8P, because, and I'm going to read this just briefly, it says that the RFC assessment must always consider and address medical source opinions. If the assessment conflicts with an opinion from a medical source, the adjudicator must explain why the opinion was not adopted. Now, in this case, there was a report from an examining psychologist that essentially said that this lady was disabled. She would only be able to do part-time work. She would be considered disabled if that was given great weight. And the court, in its merits decision, referred directly to and relied upon 96-8P as the source and the reason that they reversed. Now, they also mentioned a regulation, 404.1527D, that says that the source opinions, medical source opinions, must be evaluated, or Social Security promises to do so.
But, Mr. Shull, I mean, what this case really asks us to do is decide how broad or narrow a perspective should we take with respect to the commissioner's decision to defend a particular decision before the district court. You would like us to zero in on the one point, the 96-8P point in this particular instance, that caused the district court to issue the sentence for remand, whereas the commissioner has argued that it's a more comprehensive look. And if, I mean, there was a lot of evidence in this record that could have led to a decision to deny benefits, not every last piece of it. There'll be, you know, we'll see what happens. But it seems to me that it's a harsh view to say that the commissioner loses the opportunity to show substantial justification because of, you know, one ruling that perhaps was overlooked inadvertently, perhaps, you know, who knows what, but simply it's not like the commissioner wrote a brief that was devoted to debunking 96-8P.
Well, it's not a minor point. I mean, based on this opinion, the claimant would have been found disabled if that was given weight. So my client had...
Do we know that? I mean, that could have been, or perhaps... on some balance, I don't know that it's inevitable that the claimant would have been found disabled based on that doctor's opinion.
No, but I'm the client, or the plaintiff was a prevailing party based upon the decision, the merits decision of the court.
I don't disagree with that. I don't think anybody's arguing prevailing party wasn't satisfied given the law and sentence for remands. It's the substantial justification for the commissioner's position, notwithstanding the fact that the commissioner lost. That's what we have to decide. You know, was it frivolous? Was it substantially justified? Obviously, it wasn't a winning argument, or the commissioner would have won. You know, so substantial justification asks us, you know, somewhat difficult question. Even though you lost, you know, was there a basis for the position you took?
Well, look, the ruling definitely says this is a medical source statement. This is a contrary to the RFC. There's no dispute about that, and it's something that the ALJ did not analyze. I mean, it's not some minor point in this case. It's a point on which the claimant can turn. And she had to go to federal court to sue to get this considered. Now, if the claimant has to prove all this other stuff in federal court that, well, you know, this opinion is wrong and that opinion is wrong and that opinion is wrong, I mean, what's left of EJIA? I mean, there's always going to be some grounds upon which the government acts that are legitimate. And there may be a lot of good things in the opinion. The ALJ may have done a lot of good things right.
Well, it's not the ALJ that has to be substantially justified. It's the commissioner, right? It's what position did the commissioner take before the various, well, before the district court.
That's right? Correct. And they knew or should have known that this opinion was a medical source opinion and that it conflicted with the RFC and that it was legal error not for the ALJ not to explain why he rejected the opinion.
So you think the only thing the government responsibly could have done in the district court is confess error? That's what it sounds like.
In this case, I believe that, yes, that's the case. I mean, there was a clear error of law. And that's enough for remand.
About harmless error? Are there any harmless error concepts in Social Security litigation?
Yes, but they didn't raise any harmless error, and it certainly wasn't a harmless error because 96AP also says that a person can only work part-time. They would be disabled at step 5. Now, this is a step 4 decision.
Right.
There was some argument about that, but the district court upheld our position on that. I mean, in this particular case, I mean, what does the plaintiff have to, have to do? Do they have to negate everything or most things on the position that the government made? Yes, the government may believe that they have good reasons for defending the fact that this person is not disabled, but the primary issue, the focus in this case, now not the only issue, but I think the focus should be on the error made by the government that led to the reversal. Because otherwise, I think that the EJIA statute is going to be greatly reduced. There's clients are not, or plaintiffs are not going to be able to, assert their rights to EJIA fees and get attorneys to represent them in federal court if they have to prove that so much of the government's case is incorrect. If I have to show in district court...
Now it sounds like you're just disagreeing with the judgment of Congress that it's not enough to win, that you have to show that the government's position was substantially unjustified. Much of your argument on your feet and much of your argument in the brief seems to be that plaintiffs should get attorney's fees automatically. That's not what the statute says.
Well, I agree.
What do you see as the difference between what's necessary to show in order to win and what's necessary to show in order to recover attorney's fees?
Okay. Well, of course, in winning these cases, you need to take into context whether there was an error of law. And the court found that there was an error of law in this case. Now, that's not enough, as you pointed out, Judge, to show that you're entitled to EJIA fees. However, in this case, you look at it from the position of the government, and should the government have known that this was a violation of SSR 8P? And yes, it was. I mean, they made some defenses in court. Their defenses, one of their defenses was that this...
You're getting away from my question.
Okay.
I asked you to articulate, in your view, what is the difference between what's necessary to prevail as a legal matter and what's necessary to show that the government's position was substantially unjustified? I'm asking you to address the legal rule that should govern.
Well, when you get to the substantial justification part, when you look at the decision of the government to defend the case, one, was this a, I think the question would be, was this a medical assessment? Did the rule apply? And yes, it did. Was it contrary to the RFC?
I don't understand this as an articulation of a legal rule. I mean, the Supreme Court in Underwood articulated what it saw as this difference. And are you asking us to do something other than what Underwood said? Because I'm otherwise having trouble understanding your submission.
Well, Underwood says that the position of the government must be justified both in fact and in law. Okay? And is what I'm saying is, in this particular case, the position of the government is not justified in law. In this particular case, there was a ruling that says that if there is if there is a medical assessment that's contrary to the RFC, then the government that's binding on the government. It's binding on the government. Now, maybe there's some other factors. I mean, when you deal with the law, that's much more clear. I mean, I agree that Underwood says that you can't. There's no per se rules. Mm-hmm. But when you come to the fact that the government has broken the law.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Mr. Kristoff.
May it please the Court, Edward Kristoff on behalf of the Commissioner of Social Security.
Mr. Kristoff, I wonder if you could answer a question for me. In its brief before the district court defending the decision, I've been looking at your brief here, and I'm trying to figure out what exactly did the government have to say about Dr. Cassell's opinion. It appears that this was, in fact, presented. That was one of the key issues in the district court. On what ground did you defend with particular respect to Dr. Cassell's opinion?
Well, this is a case where the ALJ did not simply miss this report. The ALJ did discuss.
I'm asking what the government told. Did the government say we don't think 98, whatever it is, 96.8P applies, or did the government just forget to talk about that, or did the government have some reason for thinking that even taking that into account, the weight of the evidence, or, you know, something? How did the government deal with the point that wound up, in hindsight, being dispositive in the district court?
What the government suggested, are you asking what the government said at district
court? I want to know what was the government's position, because as I understand this, we're trying to figure out if, notwithstanding the loss, the government's position was substantially justified. And I want to know, what did the government say to the district court? Did you just omit that part of your brief, or what did you say about it?
No, the government did not say that 96.8P did not apply to this case. We did not suggest that at all. What we said was that even with 96.8P in the picture, that there's still some margin for argument that the level of articulation in this case was enough.
Didn't you argue to the district court that Dr. Kissel's opinion appeared to reflect Ms. Conrad's preferences regarding part-time work rather than an objective assessment of her functional capabilities? Wasn't that the argument?
Well, we made the argument, Your Honor, that that could have been the reason that the ALJ did not feel the need to assess that part of Dr. Cassell's report, that along with some other reports in the record, there was an appearance that she was telling the doctors what she was feeling, that that's what they were parroting back in their reports. And that if that was the case, then the ALJ wouldn't have been obligated to go ahead and recite everything those doctors said and provide a rationale for rejecting everything that they said. So basically we're saying that the articulation was enough in this case, even though the ALJ didn't go through point by point.
Under your argument, would the government's position be substantially justified in every case in which the alleged error is the ALJ's failure to properly consider evidence or to articulate that it had considered evidence?
No, Your Honor, certainly not. We're not saying that there is a bright-line standard. In fact, we're arguing exactly the opposite. We're arguing that the substantially justified standard allows for a great deal of flexibility. And in this case, it was the district court that had just adjudicated the merits that said there is flexibility here. And under this set of circumstances, where there is evidence supporting the ALJ's decision, I'm going to say that the error here was not so much that there was not a rational basis for the ALJ's decision and for the government to defend that decision. So there is flexibility within that standard.
Do you have an answer to the question Judge Easterbrook asked your opponent? You know, what's the... How does one tell the difference between simply an argument that didn't win but that was substantially justified and an argument that's so bad it's not even substantially justified?
I believe the standard for substantially justified would have to be lower. If the government can lose and still prevail on EJIA, it has to be lower. Now, exactly what that means...
But above that, frivolous. I mean, how do we...
And where that gap lies, that is a tricky question. And that's why there has to be that flexibility, especially in a case when we're dealing with an abuse of discretion.
The problem is that you can't lose a Social Security suit on the merits unless the position is not supported by substantial evidence, which is already a pretty deferential standard.
That's right.
So in order to lose, the government's position has got to be wretched. But it's not wretched enough to get attorney's fees. How does one articulate this intermediate area between wretched and frivolous?
You know, I think in this case, we're not dealing with a wretched decision. We're dealing with a decision that missed a single point. Of all of the issues that come before this court on these Social Security disability cases, we have vocational issues and a failure to assess credibility, obesity, all those types of things. Those things were not even in dispute before the district court. We had the ALJ not even missing an entire opinion, missing one part of one opinion from a one-time consultative examiner. So I would suggest this was not a wretched decision. But to try to answer your question more directly, I mean, clearly we are dealing with an amorphous area, because the substantial evidence standard is, of course, whether a reasonable fact finder could have made that decision, and, of course, the substantially justified standard is, does it have a rational basis in law and fact? Where's the gap between those two? I would say this isn't the case to make that distinction on.
No. Wait. You need a legal standard to know how to assess the facts under the standard. You can't just say, we're operating in a law-free zone here. Let's not worry about legal rules. Let's just assess the facts. But it sounds like the argument you're making, and indeed kind of what I took from Underwood, is that this is very much like the claim of qualified immunity. The defendant in a damages action violated the Constitution, but it wasn't so clear to every reasonable person that he did so that he's not answerable in damages. Well, here it's a question of answerability and attorney's fees. Is that a good analogy?
I would accept
that. Of course, we don't really know what the qualified immunity standard means either, so it's not clear that it's an improvement.
Well, I would accept the analogy without being able to explain the qualified immunity standard.
Well, I mean, shouldn't the standard be that even if arguments don't prevail, at least they're reasonably grounded?
In law and fact.
And
that is the standard.
Here you've got Dr. Kissel, who didn't appear to tie the part-time requirement to any concrete justification. I mean, he sort of implied, it seems to me, that it was a short-term need by, you know, I mean, what he said was she needed part-time employment to start. So.
That's right. There are any number of problems with Dr. Kissel's opinion, and that's why the district court sent it back, for the ALJ to have a chance to do a better job of articulating a rationale for assessing Dr. Kissel's report.
I mean, is it at all important that this is, in fact, a sentence for remand? I mean, it's not like the district court said the only discretion the ALJ has is to enter an order for immediate benefits. There are more proceedings happening.
Definitely. And that's very important to our case, Your Honor, because this is not a case where the district court decided that the ALJ's decision was so wretched, as the judge would say, that there was clearly an award of benefits warranted in this case. No, there was simply one problem that still needs to be resolved. And we still don't have a resolution to that problem. And in that type of case, with the district court having just decided the merits of the case, I don't believe this rises to a level of an abuse of discretion. There has to be some flexibility there.
And you are arguing very strongly that the way we're However, the district court is supposed to review the application for fees. We're supposed to review the district court's decision on an abuse of discretion standard. Okay.
That, at least, was clearly clearly established in Underwood. The men ought to finish the job, but they got that far.
On that high note, I'll end if the court doesn't have any questions.
I'm sitting here trying to decide if I'd rather be frivolous or wretched. I think I come down on the side of frivolous.
Sounds like it's more fun.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our final case